Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. The conclusion of the 11-week trial of two former directors of Anglo-Irish Bank on Tuesday gave rise to extensive analysis on the airwaves this week. On Wednesday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, Dervil MacDonald of the Irish Independent gave her response to Judge Martin Nolan's decision not to jail William McAteer and Pat Whelan.
I thought of T.S. Eliot's line, "Out of the wasteland as it ended yesterday, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang but a whimper." There was a kind of subdued, kind of rueful, but in some ways very, very predictable end to the Anglo trial, because if you sat through the legal argument where major disputes occurred over the issue of whether the jury should consider whether or not the men had relied on legal advice, if you'd sat through any of that, and if you'd sat through the trial, like, I mean, the regulator was allowed to go, and the person who most destroyed Pat Neary was Pat Neary. And, you know, just to give some recollection, in his 2 days in the witness box, he said, "I don't recall 30 times, I don't know 23 times, I can't recall 12 times, I cannot remember 12 times. At one stage he said, that's a complete blank to me, I've absolutely no recollection," he said 4 times. And really his credibility was destroyed. In the end, the jury did not get to consider the role, or they were told not to consider the role of the regulator or that of legal advice in their deliberations. But what the judge, Martin Nolan, had signalled, both in the absence of the jury and in his legal advice ruling, and then subsequently in his charge to the jury, was that these were considerations, the regulator, legal advice, Morgan Stanley, that he might take into consideration in mitigation of sentence. And boy, did he do that. Normally in a sentence hearing, you hear the usual stories about how they came from a good home and they worked hard. We heard yesterday that Willie McAteer worked as a bus conductor in his salad days before he to get himself through his education. But really what it came down to when Judge Nolan issued his sentence, he was essentially saying, look, this is one arm of the state, the courts and the judiciary. I can't send these two men to jail in circumstances where another arm of the state, i.e. the regulator, essentially gave the green light to this deal. And it might seem extraordinary for people to understand how, on the one hand, Judge Nolan is saying there was an absolute blatant breach of the law, and yet no one goes to jail. I think, those of us who sat through the trial were possibly expecting that Pat Whelan and Willie McAteer might get a suspended sentence. I don't think anybody, including the prosecution, was expecting that they would get a non-custodial sentence, that they're now going to be considered for community service.
Dervil MacDonald talking to Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. But what now is likely to happen to the former chief executive of Anglo-Irish Bank, David Drum? Reports this week suggested that Gardaí are poised to file papers for his extradition. On Thursday's Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes considered how exactly this process is likely to play out. He spoke to NUI Galway Professor of Law Larry Donnelly about that process, and also about David Drum's assertion to date that it would be all but impossible for him to receive a fair trial in Ireland on the basis that he has become a scapegoat for the financial collapse. Philip's report also included inserts from the by now infamous Anglo tapes.
Deutschland, Deutschland, über alle.
That's morning. I just should be recording these calls just for the crack.
I think that argument can be fairly easy to dismantle when you look at the recent treatment in the courts of Sean Fitzpatrick in particular, who, despite being public enemy number one here for a significant amount of time, was ultimately acquitted. That would seem to me to put paid to the idea that David Drum can't get a free trial in Ireland.
The difficulty for the DPP in trying to bring that charge is that it is not a crime in America to lend people money to buy shares in your company. And if it's not a crime there, he can't be extradited to somewhere where it is.
There's no direct parallel between the relevant legislation here in Ireland and in the United States. But the DPP is looking through the files and going over the files, and we know what's come to light in the context of the Anglo trial, but we don't know what else might be in there that may be charged, that could be chargeable offences, additional chargeable offences for Mr. Drum that actually would also be crimes in the United States.
So the charge has to be chosen very, very carefully, but it's not open, is it, to the Gardaí to seek to have him extradited on parking offences or whatever and then slip in a Section 60 of the Companies Act charge later on?
No, that can't be done. There's a doctrine called speciality, which mandates that the individual who's to be extradited can only be charged with the specific offence that's contained in the extradition warrant.
If it was the failure of the Maple 10 scheme, that led to the unravelling of Sean Quinn's position in Anglo, that propelled that bank into a liquidity crisis, followed then by a solvency crisis, that contributed to the offering of the blanket guarantee, that bankrupted the country? That is something that the DPP is still going to have a hard time getting David Drum back to Ireland to answer questions on.
Philip Boucher-Hayes there reporting on Thursday's Drive Time. One man who did make it to court was Peter, a caller to Wednesday's Liveline. Peter was in court to face a charge related to company law, but unlike the Anglo executives, he did receive a custodial sentence.
Many counts were you found guilty of under the Companies Act? It was not keeping company records, is that correct?
It was nearer, yeah. 7 sample charges.
OK, when are you going to prison?
Going to prison tomorrow.
Why?
I was fined initially €7,000.
Right.
I couldn't pay that. And then I went back to court on appeal or something like that. I'm not overly familiar with the court systems. Oh. And it was reduced to €700. I still can't pay that.
Were you offered community service at any stage?
No.
Were you referred to the probation service for consideration for community service?
No.
To help maybe clean out a graveyard or help with Meals and Wheels in your local community?
No.
Would you have done that?
Yeah, no problem.
Would you have done, the minimum you would have been asked to do is 24 hours of community service, and the maximum you would have been asked to do is 240 hours, which it could be 20 days or 30 days or whatever over a period. Would you have considered that if the judge had asked that you be assessed for community service?
Yeah.
Are you?
No, I'm going to prison. I've been told to go to prison. If I had been told to do community service, I would have done that. There's no problem. I mean, I'm law-abiding. I've no other charges. I'm going to prison for £700. And bear in mind, I wasn't running a sweatshop now or anything like that. All the staff I had, it was a pub restaurant. The staff were more than happy there. There was never a complaint about me. I'm hiring staff, either directly or indirectly, for over 30 years. I mean, what's the purpose of sending me to jail? I'm employed at the moment. I have to ring up, tell my employers that I'm going to prison for a couple of days. You know, they can't believe it.
And you sound very calm about it, in one sense.
Well, I mean, what can I do about it? I mean, I can't go on the run or anything like that, you know. When I return home, I'll be arrested anyway.
From Wednesday's Liveline. Another story which dominated the news agenda towards the end of the week was the arrest and questioning of Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams in relation to the murder of Jean McConville in 1972. Michael McConville was 11 years old on the night his mother was abducted from their home in the Divis Flats in Belfast. He recalled the events of that night in an interview with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday.
The IRA had came to the door and she was crying. We were all crying. We were holding on to her.
How many people came in?
It was roughly about between 10 and 12 people. Some of these people had masks on and some of them hadn't got masks on.
You recognised some of them?
I knew them. They were neighbours from the area.
How many of them did you recognise?
It was at least 3 or 4 what I recognised. My older brother probably recognised more of them. My older sister probably recognised more of them as well.
And what happened in the days after that, Michael?
We were left on our own for roughly about 6 weeks. The day after that, we were just all stayed in the house. We were waiting on information about our mother. Was she going to come back? What the IRA was doing with her? The IRA told us what they would only have her for a short period of time. We never seen or heard tell of her mother.
How did you realise that she was dead?
I realised how she was dead when an IRA man came to the house and gave her her purse and her rings, her wedding rings back. That's when I realised my mother was dead.
Did he say she was dead or did he explain
why
he was dead?
He just turned around and he left the purse and the rings with one of the family members.
You yourself got a fairly direct and blunt warning from the IRA around about that time as well, didn't you?
It was about a week later. I was going to my grandmother's house and the IRA grabbed me, stuck a hood over my head. It was a sleeve of a woolly jumper. When they pulled it down, I could see through it. They brought me down the stairwell. They brought me to a house. They tied me to a chair and they beat me with sticks and they put a gun to my head and they were threatening to shoot me. They said they were going to shoot me if I told anything about any members of the IRA. And this went on for about 3 hours. And at the end of it, they said they were going to shoot me and they fired a cap gun and stuck a penny from my leg.
Did you recognise through the woolly jumper any of the people who took you on that occasion, or were they masked?
No, I recognised two of them. Two of them were young lads, about 15 or 16 at the time.
And that is a warning that has stayed with you right up to this day?
Well, ever since that door, none of us really spoke about it. We were scared. They put the fear of God on us. I realised then, when they could do this here till 11-year-old jail, that they did murder my mother.
Michael McConville talking to Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. Later in the day, Jude White, whose mother was killed by loyalists 30 years ago, spoke to Joe Duffy on Liveline. He also gave his response to Joan Burton's comment that the murder of Jean McConville should be classified as a war crime.
Nobody has been caught, no, and I don't want anybody caught. And if they're listening to the Joe Duffy show, as I'm sure they are, I forgive them and I want them to get on with their life, because there is nothing I want further than to drag an elderly man or woman into a prison cell for something that they did 40 years ago. And I mean, the context of that comment is that it's impossible for people living in a normal society to understand the toxicity and hatred that was in this society in the 70s. The poison that created the minds for a stranger to come to my home and murder my mother, that poison is slowly secreting out of this society. Adams, by the way, is one of the main reasons it is secreting out of this society. So I have no issue whatsoever. Indeed, yeah, if I knew who it was, I wouldn't tell the police. No interest in revenge whatsoever. I would like to know the truth, perhaps, but I certainly have no issue about revenge or anybody going to jail, Joe. What happened to Jean McConville is indefensible. I mean, if her family are listening, I share with you the pain of losing a loved one. When somebody says it's a war crime, I can't imagine that the Geneva Convention ever applied up here. You were guilty up here simply by coming out of a Catholic church. You were guilty simply by talking to a policeman or being a policeman or being a civilian. And I have to ask, you know, people like Joan Bruton and people who, you know, inflame the situation, in my view, by many of these comments. Where does this end? Can we draw a line? Can we shake each other's hand? Can we apologise to each other? And can we leave something for our children that isn't dysfunctional, fractured and poisoned, not to the core, but from the core?
Jude White talking to Joe Duffy on Thursday. Also in that same programme, Mary Quinn, a first cousin of Anna Massey, who was killed in the Dublin bombing 40 years ago, gave her perspective on forgiveness.
Anna was killed
and
in the Dublin bombing.
Yeah. She was the only person killed coming down by Trinity College. Yeah. And she was working in Lisney's, and she got off early that day because she was to be married 2 weeks after the bombing. And they bought a house in Allen Bray, and she was coming down. He said, come home early because of the surprises after getting a company car. That's how she happened to be there. She wouldn't have been there. You know, it was all faith. And she was killed at Trinity College, the only one there on the, you know, May
70, the Friday
1974.
Evening.
So I wonder, would Minister Burton think that her death was a crime, war crime? No, they'll never, nobody will ever be got for them murders. Mm-hmm. And we live with that every day. We adore the ground she walked on. You know, everyone has their troubles, and we've all, it's like North and South. And we're for a forgiven family. And as like that man said, I don't think we ever want to know who done this. No point in raking over the coals. I feel, I'm personally speaking, I'm not speaking for Anna's family.
I know that,
they
I know.
They might feel different, but she's my first cousin. And I know my Uncle Frank, the light of heaven to him, and Auntie Annie. And the Uncle Frank said, look, you know, we can't turn back the clock. You know, it's all written above for us, that what we think. And they were really, they went everywhere about it, and they forgave them. Uncle Frank held my hand and he said, Mary, may God forgive them. And I know, he said, I forgive them and God will forgive them, he said. They took our beautiful, precious Anna, and, you know, we will never, and our sisters, none of us will ever forget her.
Mary Quinn talking to Joe Duffy on Thursday's Liveline. Also on Thursday, we heard about the publication of the report into the death of Gary Douch, who died after he was beaten to death in an overcrowded cell in Mountjoy Prison in August 2006. On Friday's Morning Ireland, former Governor of Mountjoy, John Lonergan, spoke about the newly published report and conditions in Mountjoy at that time.
The crisis was caused by the numbers of prisoners that were being committed to Mountjoy. Mountjoy was the committed prison at that time for Leinster, Dublin and the counties of Monaghan and Cavan. It was incapable of accommodating the numbers of prisoners that were being forced into Mountjoy on a daily basis. And the result was that the prison was, you know, the regime in Mountjoy every single night, and every staff member would confirm this, the regime in Mountjoy every single night, 365 days in the week, was prison officers running around with mattresses under their... elbows, trying to, and under their arms, trying to provide accommodation for prisoners.
Did you ever think of resigning?
I certainly regret one thing, and that was that towards the end of my time in Mountjoy, I regret the fact that I did not refuse to take prisoners when the prison became overcrowded. I should have done that. Now, it would have been illegal to do it, but it would have been, it was something that I should have done, and it was something that I failed to do.
But if there were all of these failings in the jail, as identified by the report, and you're the line manager on the spot, complaining in general terms, but obviously knowing a lot more than you could say publicly at the time, I'm just wondering, did you ever think of saying to your superiors, I can't, this is too dangerous. Yeah. It's unsafe, as the report says, for prisoners and staff. I'm going to resign unless something is done about it. Did you ever say that?
I think, to be fair to myself, and I have to be fair to myself, I have to say that I did actually publicise it quite a lot.
Did you ever think of resigning because it was so dangerous?
Well, I certainly notified the authorities on several occasions. I wrote an annual report every single year, highlighting the chaos that was in Mountjoy, the danger. On the 29th of June 2006, I wrote a letter saying that the safety and welfare of staff and prisoners in the B basement of Mountjoy was at serious risk. There is very little else a governor can do in the circumstances to do that.
You never threatened to resign?
I never threatened to resign, but I don't believe for one moment that would have made any difference. Right. They'd probably have been delighted if I did.
The former governor of Mountjoy Prison, John Lonergan, talking to Cathal McQuillan on Friday's Morning Ireland. The annual GRA conference also received lots of media attention this week. One of the topics up for discussion at this year's conference was the number of assaults on Gardaí. On Wednesday's Today show, Valerie Cox spoke to a number of Gardaí who have sustained serious injuries from assaults. One of those she spoke to was Garda Geoffrey White.
November 2006, I was observer. I was in a patrol car attached to Kevin Street Garda Station. We responded to a call where there was a person looking for assistance, Concolbert Roundabout, Kilmainham. When we arrived at the scene, an individual approached the rear of our car and tried to open the door. As I opened the door, my car turned and hit me with a broken bottle. Broke my nose, lacerations my face, ended up having to be taken to James's Hospital. At the time, I got out of the patrol car and gave chase. She was arrested at the time, but...
And how serious was it?
I ended up with 28 stitches externally and a number of stitches internally and a broken nose at the time, which had to be rebroken and set again.
And did you ever find out why she did it?
No. It appeared to be just random. She had assaulted other people at the time. I don't know if it was because I was a guard or why.
Were you in uniform?
I was in uniform in a marked patrol car with lights and sirens activated. It wasn't as if you didn't know I was a guard.
So were you out of work for a long time?
Just over 2 months out of work.
And how does that affect you now? I mean, were you happy to go back to policing or would you be more cautious?
I suppose it'll bring a degree of caution to anyone after something like that. I was happy to go back to policing. It's what I wanted to do. But obviously it will bring a degree of caution when you're dealing with incidents or a degree of alertness when you come to an incident.
And you still have the scars?
Yeah, I'm still left with scars. I'll be more noticeable when I'm out in the sun or out in the cold, things like that. But I'll always have some scarring in relation to it.
Garda Geoffrey White talking to Valerie Cox for the Today Show on Wednesday. Now, you might have heard news reports on Tuesday about the arrest of a man who tried to gain access to Leinster House while brandishing a sword. Junior Minister Sean Sherlock gave an eyewitness account of that incident to Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time.
I was walking into a meeting into the Dáil, so I was coming from the main gate into the revolving doors, and before I hit the revolving doors, as it were, a gentleman came storming past me who was brandishing a sword, and his intention was to try and get access to the building. And when I say he was brandishing a sword, it was, you know, quite literally a long sword, I would say, waist high to myself at least, and something that you would imagine that would have been drawn from a scabbard. But he was apprehended comprehensively by the Gardaí by the time, you know, he got through the revolving door, so he didn't actually gain access to the building.
How close were you to him, Sean, and did he say anything?
Well, I don't recall him shouting or roaring or anything like that, because I was walking quietly on my way into a meeting. There would have been maybe one or two other people in the front part of Leinster House, if you will. He was quite silent. I turned around. It was quite a surreal thing to see a number of Gardaí, you know, chasing somebody into the building, somebody who was brandishing a sword. His clear intention was to try and gain access to the building.
Junior Minister Sean Sherlock talking to Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time. It was race week in Punchestown, and there was lots of coverage of all of the action in sports bulletins throughout the week. On Thursday's Drive Time, however, we heard from Frances Hyland, Secretary of the Irish Track Bookmakers Association, about the changed and changing nature of the betting industry. He spoke to Pádraig Lodge.
Racing has changed nowadays. The big punting is not done anymore on the racecourse. In fact, the big punting is not done in racing anymore to some extent. It's losing market share. But life has changed considerably. When I was at your age, the only place you could have a cash bet was on a Greyhound stadium or a racecourse or in a betting shop. The only place. And they were very strict times of betting shops staying open. But now, effectively, there's 24-hour a day gambling. And that has changed the whole face of betting. And we are, of course, now from being the sole, the prime funders of Irish racing, we're irrelevant. The racecourse bookmaker is irrelevant.
We see a lot of businesses going to the wall or struggling to survive. Are you hearing stories of bookmakers who just can't make a living out of this anymore?
But look it for yourself. Empty pitches at the Punchestown Festival. There has not been empty pitches in the history of Punchestown. And now they're empty pitches. So that sells something.
Frances Hyland talking to Pádraig Lodge on Thursday's Drive Time. Staying with sport, and this time with the very minority sport of ultra running. On Tuesday's Drive Time, Greg Allen spoke to Ian Keith shortly after he won a 6-day event at Corona Park in New York. Ian quit after he had completed 500 miles when it was clear that nobody was likely to beat him.
My first few days went very well indeed, and the race becomes very hard as time goes on. The priority then tends to reduce somewhat. I could carry on running and do another 20, maybe 30 miles, or I could go have a bath and relax and lie down. And after 5.5 days, 3/4 days of running, the temptation of a bath is overwhelming. But 500 became very much a good target for me. It looked like something that was well within range. And I could comfortably hit, and I would ensure that I'd win the race by quite a margin, and that's what I did, basically.
Break it down over the days. How many miles did you run on the first day, for example? And by as the race went on, you said it got hard. I'm not too surprised at that. How did your mileage diminish somewhat?
It diminished quite a lot. So the first day is, you're always going to get your best mileage on the first day because you don't need to sleep at all because you're riding in fresh. So you can do it the full 24 hours without stopping. So I did 124 miles on the first day, which in a 24-hour race wouldn't be great, but in a 6-day race is fantastic. It was a huge mileage. I think the second day I did just a little under 100. I think it was about 96 or something like that, which again was a very good day two total. Didn't take too much sleep there, a couple of hours here and there. But the problem is by day two, you're starting to really feel all the pain where you're going to feel it, and your feet start to get incredibly tired. And it's basically a hurdle you have to try and get over. You know the pain is going to be there. So then the third day, just short of hitting 300 miles for three days. And again, it just started tapering a bit from there. What was happening to me is I was getting more sleep deprived and I was needing to take longer sleeps. Probably another factor was when I was waking up from the sleep, I was still so confused that it was taking me half an hour to get going to just work out where I was, what I was doing, and what did I need to do next.
Quite apart from the physical pain, mentally, what do you think about when you're going on a 1 mile circuit over and over and over again?
And over again. You think about lots of whatever it takes to get you through. What's very helpful for me is Helen, my wife, is out here as well. So when she's on the course, it always helps to be running towards Helen and seeing her at the aid station every lap. You know, that's something to look forward to.
Ultra runner Ian Keith talking to Greg Allen for Drive Time Sport on Tuesday. From running to dancing, it's hard to believe, but it's 20 years since Riverdance first leapt onto the set of Eurovision. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, reporter Louise Byrne went along to the Good Counsel Fesh in Naas, County Kildare, where she met Emer O'Grady, one of the original Riverdancers. Emer was at the Fesh with her daughter Niamh.
The 30th of April 1994, I was one of the original members of the Riverdance troupe. On the day, we had a technical rehearsal, and it was at that point that we kind of realised this was something big. The technical crew actually gave us a standing ovation, So we were kind of thinking, okay, this is looking good. And then that night, then it was just phenomenal. There was tears backstage. People got a fright. We got such a response. I think it's brought a lot more people back into the Irish dancing. I think it was kind of, not that it was dying off, but I think a lot more people now are involved in it. And with Riverdance, everybody wants their children to do it.
Can you believe it was 20 years ago?
I can't, but my body can.
None of the competitors taking part in this fete were born when Riverdance began, but every single one of them counts it as an inspiration. And perhaps that is Riverdance's greatest legacy.
I love the hard shoes. And when they're in the light shoes, they're so light on their feet.
They're really good. They can kick really high.
When you were a bit older, Lara, would you like to be part of Riverdance?
Yeah.
Looking at the footwork, how fast they were going, I think my mind was just mad. I couldn't take it all in, so I had to watch it a few times. And as soon as I watched it, I said to my mum that I really want to dance.
I remember the first time I saw it, and I was mind blown. I just couldn't believe how they could move their feet that fast, and I wanted to learn how to do that. I jumped up, and then I tried to copy them. And then I haven't stopped since, yeah.
From Louise Byrne's report on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. 8 days in November was this week's documentary on One, in which Aoife Kavanagh revisited a week in 2002 in which 8 people entered the River Slaney in Enniscorthy, County Wexford. 5 died and 3 were saved. 12 years on, Aoife spoke to the families of those who died and the rescue volunteers in the town.
When it began to happen, it was sort of one, and, you know, you hear about these things and you think, oh my God, that's awful. But then they began to happen, bang, 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 one after the other. And in some sense, I think people became desensitized almost. And when you see the helicopter hovering, you think, oh my God, not another one. And then you began to think that, okay, so, yeah, of course, there are so many, but it's still somebody's son, daughter, you know, that you have to bring it back to a personal level. But it seemed at one stage that there was some kind of, I don't know, pall over Wexford and Enniscorthy, that, you know, there were so many, and were they all copycat, and who was going to be next? You know, it was really a traumatic time, I think, for everybody.
One of the men who went into the Slaney that weekend was Billy Dwyer. Billy was known as Hutchie in the town. John Byrne was one of the first to reach the river that evening.
And then there was, I think it was Billy Dwyer, Hutchie, that went in, and we got the call that night. We ran to the boathouse, obviously, and we put the boats out. And that time Billy vaguely see him at the end of the prom in the water. And just within minutes, he was gone.
Hutchie's sons were young boys back in 2002, and naturally the family tried to shield them from what was happening. But Podge Dwyer, who was just 10 at the time, has very clear memories of that November.
I was 10, about to turn 11, and I can just remember for some reason I got up really early that morning, and I went down to the sitting room and everybody was in the sitting room, and like I knew something was up, and then the news just broke, and I kind of didn't know what to think at the time. Like, it was kind of like a punch in the chest or something. And like, it wasn't really the fact that what happened really got to me. It was the fact of waiting and finding out. Because no matter how realistically you think, if that happens with a family member, there is an ounce of hope that when they're found, they're going to be found alive. Like, and that was really the worst part of it, that the waiting to find out. Obviously, it took a lot longer for my father to be found than I thought it would, but for the first few days at least, like, maybe he was washed up onto the shore and he's just stuck somewhere or something. But as the time went on, like, you just kind of accept it.
It was heartbreaking to see. We would arrive here in the morning in the dark at 6:30 to get the canteen ready, get the boats ready, get the gear ready, and the family would be standing out in the car park waiting to go at that. It wouldn't be bright now until 8 o'clock, and they'd be all standing in the car park. And it was heartbreaking to come up along the quay at night, and so many family members standing there waiting, any news, and every night it was just the same. No news, maybe tomorrow.
From Aoife Kavanagh's documentary 8 Days in November, which was produced by Liam O'Brien for last week's Documentary on One. Journalist Robert Fisk was Mary McCallaghan's guest in studio last Sunday. As well as talking about his work reporting from the Middle East, he also spoke about his troubled relationship with his father.
When he grew old, he had become very right-wing, very racist in his views about black people, Irish people. I could hardly bring myself to talk to him. And when he was dying, I didn't go and see him in his nursing home.
It's obviously not for others to judge, but was it quite harsh for you not to go and see him in his nursing home when he was dying?
No, I didn't want to see him. I remember very clearly. I was in Beirut. I was reporting 93. I was reporting the Lebanese civil war still at that stage, or the remnants of it. It finished, of course, in 1990. It wasn't clear he was dying. My mother found it very difficult to cope with him. As I say, she was younger than him. And he was becoming very belligerent. In the last 10 years of his life, he would deliberately try to provoke me in politics. And, of course, stupidly, I fell for it. My mother was quite different. I mean, I had quite different feelings towards her. But my father could be quite cruel to my mother as well, which was very clear to me, you know, for many years. So I remember being in Beirut, and I heard he'd gone into a nursing home. But, in fact, he died within a week. I went and arranged his funeral, of course.
Did you cry when he died?
No, not at all.
Did you cry when your mother died?
Nope. I've got used to the idea that you don't cry at such episodes. You know, in the Middle East, there are plenty of reasons to feel anguished at what you see. But you're not there to cry. You're there to report. And when my parents died, it was a moment to reflect upon them and what they lived through. First and Second World Wars, for example. I was very angry when my mother died, because just before she died, President Clinton launched his cruise missile strikes on Afghanistan and Sudan, where he destroyed a factory, a pharmaceutical factory, which he claimed was a chemical weapons factory. It was a lie, again, as usual. And I was very struck by the fact that the amount of money spent by the United States in cruise missiles was greater than the total amount spent on Parkinson's research just in that one night. And so I actually, at the church, at my mother's funeral service, she said she wanted lots of flowers and no one dressed in black. Some women, the old biddies came in black, of course, foolishly, but everyone else dressed cheerfully. And I actually said to the very large number of people in this old church, you know, if Clinton and the Americans and the British had spent enough, as much on Parkinson's research as they spent on that one missile attack on Sudan and Afghanistan the previous week. And I actually banged on my mother's coffin. I said, my mother would not be in this box today. And you could have, you know, heard the proverbial pin drop. I could see the old ladies about to fall off their seats, you know. This was not what they expected.
Robert Fisk talking to Miriam O'Callaghan last Sunday. Miles Dungan was a guest in the Today studio on Wednesday. Miles came in to talk about his new book, Mr. Parnell's Rottweiler, about Charles Stuart Parnell's Land League newspaper, United Ireland.
But if they were being sat on by the authorities, they had to be fairly adept then at how they managed to get the sheet on the streets.
They were extremely adept because, for a start, O'Brien, although he didn't admit it at the time, O'Brien essentially continued to edit the newspaper while he was in Kilmainham jail. They had an underground train system. I mean, bear in mind that Parnell was getting out letters to Catherine O'Shea on an almost daily basis. So it was very easy to smuggle stuff out of Kilmainham jail. So O'Brien continued to write, and he wrote most of United Ireland. He continued to write it when he was in jail. What they did was the Ladies Land League became involved. Some of them actually became expert typesetters, or they were trained to set type. They became briefly involved while O'Brien and others were in jail. It was printed in Liverpool. It was printed in London. It was eventually printed in Paris, and it was smuggled into Ireland. And the RIC, or the Dublin Metropolitan Police, would either go into newsagents and literally take copies from the counter, or they would attempt to get it at the port and catch it at the port on the way into Ireland.
So how effective was it then in the rise of Parnell in bringing that about?
It was absolutely essential in the rise of Parnell. He didn't do it on his own. He didn't do it, you know, based on his cuddly personality, that's for sure, because he didn't have a cuddly personality. United Ireland essentially mythologised Parnell. It deified Parnell. It was Pravda. It was like what I imagine a North Korean newspaper would have been like and would still be like during the Kim era, which is still with us. So that it's essentially portrayed this political figure, this supreme political judge, this man who could do no wrong, essentially. And they bent over backwards when he did something, or when his policy changed. Suddenly, the policy of United Ireland would change, and when he jumped, they would jump with him. But they were behind him at all times, and they were protecting him because they were seen as a radical newspaper. They made him look far more radical than he actually was. In fact, Parnell was a very, very conservative figure.
Miles Dungan talking to Sean O'Rourke about his new book, Mr. Parnell's Rottweiler, on the Today Show on Wednesday. My personal favourite radio guest of the week was 14-year-old Thomas McCabe from Summerhill, County Meath, who came into the Mooney studio on Thursday to talk about his prosthetic eye and the accident he had at the age of 4 in which he lost his right eye. He was also joined in studio by consultant ophthalmologist Michael O'Keefe. But be warned, if you're squeamish, Thomas's story is a little gruesome, but trust me, it's well worth hanging in there for.
I was 4 and me and my friend were picking apples off a tree, and we decided to come up with a game to see if you could jump and grab the apple. And I jumped and I grabbed the apple, and the twig came down with as long with the apple, and I fell and the twig went into my right eye.
And then what happened?
And then I was running towards the house and I fell and it went in again, and then Mam thought I was stung by a wasp, but she wasn't in. Then she came out, she had a big fright. And then we rang the ambulance and I was brought into Temple Street.
So you basically made it from the garden to the kitchen, meet your mam halfway sort of thing, and you had a stick.
Yeah, in my...
Straight through your eye, impaled in your eye, to all intents and purposes, right in there like a stake.
Yeah.
And were you screaming? Were you crying? Were you in pain?
Yeah, all those things.
All of those kind of things at the same time.
Yeah.
And in shock as well, I'll bet.
Yeah.
And your poor mum, when she got it, she must have got the fright of her life.
Yeah, she went a bit crazy.
I bet she did. So you went to Temple Street Hospital. And when you got to Temple Street Hospital, what happened to you?
I was doctor, I forget his name now, but he did an operation on my eye. I think it was the next day, to get the stick out, and it was a pretty long procedure.
So you had the stick in your eye overnight?
I think so, was it?
In fact, it was worse than that.
Was it you, Michael? Were you there when he came in?
No, I only came in after this was over and took over and looked at his care afterwards, and particularly when he got his fellow eye involved. No, Thomas, actually, the stick went right through the side of the eye into the temporal lobe of his brain, and was so serious as that. Stuck in his brain, literally, when he came into the hospital.
Yes, I know, it is a little gruesome, but in this next bit, Thomas tells us about his new eye versus his old eye.
I had one a few years ago, and that I got not from John Facey Larry, and every time I looked up, it used to just slip out of my eye.
Oh.
And it used to fall out everywhere. Like,
oh, God, could you imagine?
Like, you can't, when you get an eye...
Great Halloween trick, mind you.
Yeah, when you used to get eyes off the other people, if it didn't fit you, like, you couldn't send it back, you had to kind of take it.
Do you feel better with your new eye, can I ask you, than you did with the old eye?
Because the other one, you kind of looked like... Some of them, you nearly half looked like that lad from Harry Potter with the big bulging thing coming out of his eye. John Facey Larry, he said he's making something that, you know the way like your eye, kind of, your pupil gets bigger?
Yeah, it dilates, yeah.
Yeah, he said he's making a thing that's powered, and when it's sunny in this fake eye, or the prosthetic eye, that the pupil will dilate.
Bling!
Yeah, and then it will retract, and you can turn it on and off by an app on your iPhone.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thomas McCabe and Professor Michael O'Keefe talking to Derek Mooney on Thursday. A tribute concert which celebrated the life and work of Seamus Heaney, recorded earlier this month at the National Concert Hall, was broadcast on Radio 1 on Sunday night. Compared by John Kelly, the concert featured a host of music, readings and poetry. This is Paul Muldoon reading Miracle.
Miracle. Not the one who takes up his bed and walks, but the ones who have known him all along, and carry him in. Their shoulders numb, the ache and stoop deep locked in their backs. The stretcher handles slippery with sweat. And no let up until he's strapped on tight, made tiltable and raised to the tiled roof, then lowered for healing. Be mindful of them as they stand and wait for the burn of the paid out ropes to cool. Their slight lightheadedness and incredulity to pass. Those ones who had known him all along.
Paul Muldoon reading Miracle at the Seamus Heaney tribute concert at the National Concert Hall, as heard on Radio 1 on Sunday. To comedy now, last night's Callan's Kicks gave us a characteristically different take on one of the big news stories of the week.
All right, Mr. Adams, you just get to make one phone call, all right? Just one call only. Make it quick.
I'll be very quick, officer. Thanks very much. Hello, Tad. Listen, it's me. Yeah, I know I shall be home to tuck you in and cuddle you all night long, but something's come up. No, of course there's no one else. You know you're the only teddy bear for me. Look, I know you're upset and you probably don't even want to talk to me right now, but please listen, it's very important. The players and I have taken me in, so I may be gone for a few days. Yeah, I know I said those days were over, but I thought they were too. But listen, are you looking after the rest of the family? Oh, good. Kiss Ducky Arloff good night for me. And don't let wee Wolfie Tone stay up too late, all right? And if Touchy Bear is fiddling with Cabbage Patch Doll again, just don't tell the police. Let me deal with it when I get home, all right? Okay? All right, love you, Ted. Update my Twitter feed for me when I'm out, okay? Love you. Good night. Bye-bye.
From last night's Callan's Kicks. Staying with comedy, Mario Rosenstock was a guest on the John Murray Show on Thursday when he introduced us to some of the characters who feature in his new show, as well as some of his old favourites.
Joan is in the news this week. Yes. She gave a very lukewarm endorsement, yes, of her party leader.
She said something like, "John, can I just say I'm standing right behind Eamon Gilmore with a huge machete?"
Yeah, that was it, reading between the lines.
Thank you, Joan.
Well, at least if she did become leader, we would know what she means and know what she says. We certainly would.
She also came to my show in the Board Gosh a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I think she tried to stay anonymous by coming to the show, but she was the only person in the audience wearing a pair of shades. Literally, she was wearing a pair of shades. And I went, sorry, who's that person wearing shades? And this person looked up at me a bit like that scene in Fawlty Towers when Prunella Scales is trying to pretend she's la la la. And I go, "Is that you, Joan?" And I went, "Hi, Joan." And she looked back in embarrassment. "Hi, Mario. You're playing a blinder up there."
Go away.
Yeah, so yeah, we exchanged words. Yeah, she has. From one end of the theatre to the other. But she was wearing shades, so she stood out a mile.
So we would be guaranteed that the next possible leader of the Labour Party has a sense of humour.
Oh, she does. Yes, I've met her on occasion too. She does indeed. She's well known for her being good crack.
Yeah, and the problem
she'd need to be right now.
Well, she would.
6%! It's a howl!
Mary Rosenstock, as heard on Thursday's John Murray Show. Another of our top comedians, Tommy Tiernan, was John's guest on Friday, meanwhile, as well as telling John about his forthcoming gig on Mount Everest. Tommy spoke about why he likes walking.
I stayed in a hotel in the city centre last night and I walked out here today.
Did you?
I did, and I got distracted on Raglan Road. Why wouldn't you? You'd have to walk down Raglan Road and sing that song to yourself, like.
Did you?
I did, of course, yeah. The ghost of Patrick Kavanagh by my side. And then I got distracted by money and I went down Shrewsbury Road just to see how... I was thinking, did people pay 52 million for a house? Like, what in the name of God are they thinking? So I walked down that. So now I'll traipse back into town when this is done and then get on the bike and ride to Cavan.
So that walk now, how long would it have taken you? Would you be at a brisk pace or would you just take it all in?
I don't know. I got here in time anyway.
That's the.
I left after. I had a double espresso and I left the hotel. So.
Yeah. Stinking time. You need it, don't you?
Ah, you do. You kind of, especially when you're doing something like a bit of radio, when you can get it wrong. So I try to walk the aegis out of myself.
I see. So by the time you arrive here...
I'll take this tool for a walk and maybe by the time I get to RTE, he'll have shut up.
Tommy also spoke about the joys of riding around Ireland on his motorbike.
Riding round Ireland at night, my God, it's special. Everything is quiet, like. Mm.
And so you would have, as I cycled, you would have got the bike from Carrickmacross last night down to Dublin.
Yeah. And
did you do it the back roads or the motorway?
I know the, you wouldn't know, a bit of both.
Yeah.
But just the way the country is at night, John. My God. She's breathing, like. She's relaxing. All the people are asleep. And the fields are just stretching, saying, thank God they've gone to bed. Thank God they've gone to bed. Yes. It's wonderful. And the sky at night, like, it's just...
Yeah.
You'd be living for it, like, it's so beautiful.
The one and only Tommy Tiernan, as heard on Friday's John Murray Show. That's about my lot for this week. Richard Curran is up next on The Business. To play us out, I picked a piece by an Irish band called We Cut Corners, who came into the Arena Studio on Thursday. This is YKK. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
YKK, are the last three letters I heard you say. YKK, are the last three letters I saw today. Someone had them written on the back. Someone had them written on the back, to front to back. Why stop now when your head doesn't know that your body's tired? And 2 miles not the best way to live, but it beats expire. I can feel it rising in my chest. I can feel it rising in my chest. Oh yes, oh yes. I pause for applause, but it never seems to come. Am I doing something wrong? Or am I doing just great? Or am I doing just great? Keep it up, you see. Underplay in the lengths you are going to get your own way and underscore in the fact the effect of rejection can be overstated. But I'll say whatever you want me to say. I'll say whatever you want me to say. Oh, okay. I appreciate the thought. That's why I'm smiling through the pain. Should I be worried that you're not? Or am I doing just great? Or am I doing just great? Keep it up, you see. Keep it up, you see. Keep it wide, KK. Keep it wide, KK. Keep it up, KK. Keep it up, you see.